Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast Weekly Intel Chat. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. Joining me today to break down the cybersecurity news being shared by the awesome InfoSec community is the one and only Matt Bromley. And don't forget, this podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud Platform, infrastructure for security operations. Think of it as a backend for your MSSP, where everything is built API first. Scale with ease and confidence as your business grows. You can start today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it. Mr. Bromley, how are you doing today, sir?
Hey, Chris, I'm doing well. How are you doing, sir? Happy mid or a little bit past mid-August to you.
Yeah.
Can you believe it, man? The summer's almost over.
Yeah, I think my daughter's starting to enter the depression phase of knowing she's going back to school.
We call that sad seasonal effectiveness disorder.
Meanwhile, mom and dad have a skip in their step.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, trust me, my kids went back to school last week and I have not been happier to wish you out the door. See ya.
Yeah. And I think it's good for them. There's too much sitting around, and I know computers are a big part of my life, but I'm hoping my kids have more outside time before they're stuck in front of the machine every day like me.
I know. We have this issue where we do exactly the thing we tell them not to do.
Yes.
So we've got to figure out a way to not let the hypocrisy shine through, maybe.
Yeah.
But I love what I do. So,
Well, I was actually thinking I just got a MetaQuest 3 and they've got a developer kit. And I was wondering if I can like do a heads up display with a Claude code terminal and then use voice to text. And then I could be out in the garden while writing code. It's,
hey, I'm going to tell you, I don't need this to happen because I would be out in the garden saying, no, another linting error, refactor the code. And I don't need to be saying those things out loud. I type them enough.
Yeah, I actually just saw an article that Claude is going to start ending abusive conversations, and I feel like I might be a little bit guilty of that.
Uh-oh. I know GitHub Copilot does that already.
Okay.
Don't ask me how I know that, but let's just say that at least it did 2 days ago.
Yeah. All right, let's get to it. We got a couple interesting ones today. First up, attackers are actively exploiting CVE-2023-46604, a remote code execution vulnerability in Apache ActiveMQ first disclosed in October 2023 that is used to compromise cloud-hosted Linux servers. Red Canary, which uncovered the campaign, observed the threat actors initially performing reconnaissance across multiple systems using the flaw. After gaining access, they selectively target only a subset of machines for further activity, deploying varying tool sets depending on the environment. In some instances, they used the Sliver C2 framework to gain full remote control, while in others, they created persistent access tunnels using Cloudflare tunnels. What's particularly notable in this campaign is the attacker's operational security approach. After compromising a server, they patch the very same ActiveMQ vulnerability they had exploited, effectively preventing the threat actors or security tools from detecting the original access vector. Red Canary suggests this step was designed to both obscure the initial intrusion method and safeguard their exclusive access. On at least one compromised server, the attackers modified the SSH configuration to allow root login, a setting typically disabled by default, ensuring maximum privilege for future access. So Matt, it looks like the bad guys have taken your advice to heart and are patching.
They finally did. Yeah, we're in a phase now where if you don't patch it, bad guys will compromise it and we'll patch it for you. Why not? I found this one to be really interesting. A hot tip to the folks over at Red Canary, number one, kind of zoomed in and highlighted on the part where we view the adversaries actually going in and cleaning up after themselves. First off, Chris, it's a 2-year-old vulnerability, like they all are. But then the adversary basically went in through an exploit. And I think this is actually pretty typical of kind of like Kinetic break-ins and stuff like that. You know, they found a loophole and it's kind of like, you know, the front door is super guarded and secured. And they found, the back door was just kind of held together by like a string lock or something. So they went in and then fixed the back door so that no one else could get in, but then left a window open off to the side where no one else knew what was going on or whatnot. And, I think that's a pretty smart way, in a weird way, but a smart way to maintain persistence. You prevent another adversary from getting in, one. Two, I'm not sure if this particular threat actor, the one who's deploying Drip Dropper here, if they've run into any sort of kind of multi-stomping ground before, Chris. I've actually worked in multiple investigations in my life where you've had multiple threat actors in the same environment. And sometimes they steer clear of each other, and sometimes they're stomping on each other without even realizing it. But I'm wondering, kind of like, of all the things that you could do, why go this route? Is it to prevent it from being scanned and detected, or is it to block another threat actor from potentially getting in? Mm-hmm. That would really be my question for them, because I could easily see, like, I could see patching the system in hopes that the system doesn't show up on a vulnerability scan and then doesn't get patched, thus eliminating your entry vector. But I'm kind of torn on the other side of it, Chris, because if a system typically doesn't allow for root SSH logins, and then you enable that, well, that creates a whole series of logs for easy analysis and stuff. So I'm looking at it a little bit like, wow, you really traded one noise for another, which makes me think that there might be another incentive, such as, hey, you know, I know the guys down the street are also going after this particular CVE, and I want to get there first. Yeah. It almost feels like planting a flag as opposed to ensuring persistence.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to think about it that way. Following the establishment of access, the attackers deployed a novel malware loader named Drip Dropper, which was an encrypted PY installer ELF binary protected by password. Its command and control communication used a hard-coded Dropbox token, allowing it to operate under the radar by leveraging a legitimate cloud platform. Once active, Drip Dropper generated two additional files. One of them exhibited dynamic behavior based on the host environment, monitoring processes or fetching instructions from Dropbox, while the other tweaked SSH settings to reinforce persistence. Both files were added to schedule tasks, enabling long-term access without requiring repeat exploitation. The use of public platforms for command and control, such as Dropbox in this case, reflect a broader trend seen in malware families like Mustang Panda and WhisperGate, which aim to blend malicious traffic with benign network flows. Finally, the decision to patch CVE-2023-46604 post-compromise follows a tactic seen previously by nation-state-level threat actors, such as those linked to China, while patching the vulnerability doesn't interfere with the attacker's ongoing access. Thanks to their persistence mechanisms, it significantly reduces the chances of defenders noticing that the system has been breached in the first place. Red Canary emphasized that regular patching, configuration hardening, and least privilege enforcement remain essentials for defending Linux infrastructure. Now, I know like Chinese APTs are a real thing, but it does seem like every article we read references China as the potential exploiter.
Yeah, we run into this one a lot as we talk about these, and of course they do. Of course, they reference the China Nexus threat actors. I think because there's a lot of overlap and a lot of things that we expect to see there. There's a large group of China Nexus threat actors, whether they're UNCs, we've talked about this on previous episode, whether they are the UNCs or whether they are the known APTs. APT 41, for example, was known to subcontract out some of their work to other adversaries. And I think when you kind of have this massive global network sprawl, Chris, it ends up kind of identifying like, wow, like, you know, almost everyone's tied in with these guys, unless it's clearly another threat actor or another country, if you will. What I find interesting, though, is this kind of part right here. There is a discussion in this article about how they see public platforms, Discord, Telegram, and Dropbox for command and control communications, and they tie them together with things like Mustang Panda, WhisperGate, which I believe is Russian Nexus, and then Chimney Sweep, which is Iranian Nexus. So some of the techniques and everything that have been observed, Chris, are actually shared amongst multiple threat actors. Mm-hmm. It may just be a few little distinct points that associate them with a China Nexus one. However, it's France's one seeing an initial access broker that utilizes the same tactics. So the other thing that might be happening is we might be seeing that kind of separation, if you will, of duties, such as, okay, the initial access looks like this, the post-exploitation looks like that, and then we're kind of looking at a summary of the activity and be like, all right, well, all of these things have been associated with, you know, China Nexus groups, Russian Nexus groups, Iranian Nexus groups, but everything's leaning more towards China Nexus groups. And it really, you know, gives an appreciation towards the job of CTI analysts who have to try and wade their way through the noise and be like, I've seen multiple countries do this thing, right? How do we lean towards one versus the other?
Yeah. So I know with this next one, there were some questions from our team as to whether it was real or not. I guess some whispers and rumors going around in some of those circles. I'm just going to go ahead and report what is in front of me. If this is something that potentially impacts your organization, please go check what the latest information is out there. So Ashes Cybersecurity has publicly disclosed a critical zero-day vulnerability in Elastic's endpoint detection and response platform, specifically in the Microsoft signed kernel driver, elastic-endpoint-driver.sys. The vulnerability, classified under CWE-476, a null pointer dereference, allows attackers to hijack the driver's functionality to bypass security controls, execute malicious code, and induce system crashes repeatedly. Despite initial attempts at responsible disclosure dating back to June 2024, Elastic has yet to issue a patch, prompting Ashes to move forward with public disclosure as of August 16, 2025. At the technical core of the issue is a logic flaw where the driver executes a call to cs:insert-kernel function using a register that can dereference a user-controlled pointer. If that pointer is null, freed, or invalid, it causes a kernel to crash due to the absence of proper validation. What makes the flaw more severe is its triggerability during normal system operations, such as compiling code or performing process injection, meaning it doesn't necessarily require attacker intervention to cause disruption under the right conditions. The vulnerable version 8.17.6 remains signed by Microsoft via the Windows Hardware Compatibility Publisher, amplifying concerns around trust in vendor-signed kernel components. So yeah, I think there's some sensitivity around this one, given what happened with CrowdStrike last year.
Might be, you know. Now, Chris, I'll be honest and say I think, just to be clear for everyone here, I think we're finding, again, if all this is true, I believe we're finding evidence of some academic or security research taking place. I'm not familiar with Ashes Cybersecurity as a larger company. It looks like they do SIM testing services and stuff like that, which, you know, makes me wonder how you found a zero day in Elastic. But that being said, very interesting. And I read through this one, and to be honest, like, it gets to the point where it seems to be causing a blue screen of death, as you mentioned. It does talk about like a null pointer dereference. This can result in a crash inside of the Elastic endpoint driver. And I think that's what immediately like kind of throws it into our purview, if you will, is it enters into the world of like, you know, security research and a security tool and everything like that. During the analysis, Ash ES Cybersecurity, I'm assuming the ES stands for Elastic Security. I'm not sure, but in any event, performs the EDR bypass, loads a custom driver, configures persistence, reboots, and then restarts the target system. So they kind of like go all the way on it, if you will. It does talk about what they tried to do from a disclosure process. Interestingly enough, you and I are talking about this 2 days later. So it's 2025. It does mention how, and I'm not sure if this is a typo on the article or not, but they discovered the flaw over a year ago. So I'm not really too sure about that one. It says
they've been trying to responsibly disclose it with Elastic, but haven't received any kind of official response or patch. So they're saying, okay, we tried the right way, and now we're just going to throw it out into the public and see if that drives some action. So I think that's where there were some questions on whether this is real or not.
Yeah, but for 14 months?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a long time to sit and wait on this thing. So that's why I said, like, maybe... For me, that impacts this story if someone's been sitting on this thing for 14 months.
Right. I guess 2 months probably makes a little more sense.
2 months, yeah. So there might be a typo in the article there, just to see. And maybe they have disclosure information in here. Okay. It looks like there was a typo in that article, which we can happy to fix because we're looking at the content. So it looks like 2025, all this has happened over the past 2.5 months or so. Oh. And that makes a little bit more sense, because for a moment I was like, wait a second, you guys have been sitting on this one for a long time. You can milk that cow a little more maybe, you know? But no, point being here, so the big takeaways, blue teamers, if this is real, if this is legitimate, you know, first off, obviously, you've got a EDR bypass. 1, 2, it's signed. 3, it is widely known. And, you know, this isn't some sort of a niche endpoint thing. And I guess maybe 4, they're not really getting much of a response from anyone. So they attempted 2 different disclosures, 1 via HackerOne, 1 via ZDI, did not get any response. So now they're independently disclosing, and here we are. I just want to let everyone know that, like, you know, Chris and I talk a lot about disclosures and what is a good disclosure, what's a bad disclosure. People who publish code on GitHub and just say, hey, you know, this is for everyone to be more secure and things like that. Chris, I think this is an example where we actually have to lean into the researcher more and say, like, they did everything they could. So I'll offer the other part of advice for everyone, which is, you know, if you're an endpoint vendor and something like this happens, respond accordingly and like deal with it. Apparently we do have a response from Elastic, and let's see, there is a response coming back from them saying they are aware that this is particular happening. And the engineering team has found no evidence supporting the claims. So Chris, I think you might have some more discussion about what's happening with this vulnerability, but here we go. We've got some drama now.
All right, so ASHES, or ASHES's proof of concept highlights the practical impacts of this flaw. Their custom attack chain begins with a C base loader that disables Elastic's defenses. It then installs a custom kernel driver, which abuses a vulnerable Elastic component to ensure long-term persistence and system instability. Upon reboot, the compromised driver forces a crash cycle, effectively bricking the machine or leaving it inoperable until offline remediation is performed. This type of privileged denial of service is particularly damaging in enterprise environments where uptime and endpoint stability are critical. More broadly, the situation underscores deep-rooted issues with vulnerability management and commercial security software. The disclosure timeline, beginning with a HackerOne report in June, followed by a ZDI submission in late July, and culminating in independent public disclosure, reflects a systemic breakdown in response processes. The fact that the vulnerability was found by a paying customer during routine testing only reinforces the argument that even well-regarded endpoint security products can become threat vectors. Finally, the use of signed kernel drivers as attack surfaces reignites longstanding concerns about the trustworthiness of digitally signed code, especially when the validation around driver behavior is insufficient. Elastic has not issued any public statement or patch at the time of disclosure. Meanwhile, the lone indicator of compromise published so far is the hash of the vulnerable driver. For now, affected organizations are advised to isolate endpoints running the vulnerable driver version and consider alternative EDR solutions until mitigation becomes available, assuming that this is actually a real thing.
See what happens. This might be one where we have to kind of wait and see. Reading through this one a little bit more, I mean, I can certainly see both sides. The researcher, I think, went into some pretty specific detail about what they saw and how it ended up. Elastic came back and said, nope, it was a different driver. It wasn't our driver at all. So we'll continue, I think, to see what happens here.
Yeah. And it does appear to be a popular topic on our internal forum these days. At least a dozen ransomware groups are now deploying kernel-level EDR killers, tools designed specifically to disable endpoint detection and response solutions as part of their malware arsenal. This development enables threat actors to bypass almost every major security vendor's software, escalate privileges, disable protections, and move on to encrypt and exfiltrate data. One of the latest to adopt this approach is Crypto 24, a relatively new ransomware strain that has already targeted close to 24 enterprises in finance, manufacturing, tech, and entertainment since April. Crypto 24 operators are using a custom version of Real Blinding EDR, an open source tool originally created to disable EDR products. Their customized variant targets a hard-coded list of 20 major security vendors, including Sophos, Bitdefender, Kaspersky, Fortinet, Trend Micro, and SentinelOne, and disables kernel-level callbacks by extracting the vendor name from driver metadata. Notably, in some observed incidents, attackers use legitimate administrative tools such as gpsscript.exe to remotely uninstall Trend Micro's Vision 1 EDR, but only after having obtained administrative privileges during early stages of compromise. Yeah, this one's definitely an eye-opener about how sophisticated threat actors are getting, starting to look at ways to take out the tools before you can detect them.
Just a little bit, right? I think this is yet another progression. It's not a new progression, but yet another thing for us to realize is that adversaries are, you know, not just trying to find out ways to exploit operating systems and vulnerabilities, but also looking to exploit and turn down the security tools. Hat tip to the security tools, because they clearly see them as a threat because they're trying to shut them down, and hat tip to security teams that lean on them. But the flip side, Chris, of course, is if it's what you're leaning on and the adversary disables your visibility, you're blinded by the, I want to say blinded by the light, but blinded by the real blinding EDR. Yeah. Bringing this up here, Interestingly enough, you know, it talks about the operators of Crypto 24, a newish ransomware group that's hit 24 companies around the world, if you will. Looking at the kind of real blinding EDR, this thing's actually fairly old. Not fairly old. It's a little bit old. It was last modified a year ago, but it does go through and talk about some of the various things of how this works. How the particular code works, the EDRs that it's able to bypass or kill. And interestingly enough, it's actually got three effects that the tool is able of doing. And Chris, I know you're going to talk a little bit more about the group themselves, but I just want to bring this focus up for our listeners and for Blue Teamers and defenders out there. The goal of this project is one of three things, either to, and I'm going in reverse order here, kill AV or EDR, permanently turn it off or disable it, or blind it. Which is interesting. And here it makes it impossible to monitor any process or threat activity, file landing, registry deletion, high privilege handle acquisition, and other sensitive behaviors. Interestingly enough, they even quote in here, not killing it directly is to ensure it maintains communication and therefore does not show that it's been disconnected. And I think that is one of the biggest kind of false comforts that security teams lean on quite often is, oh, the EDR is checking in. It must be working. Yeah. And this is why a lot of times we always say, like, if you can lean on N plus two, or I should say N plus one sources for telemetry, minimum two, that will help capture either side of what's happening. You know, an adversary disabling a single tripwire and then being practically invisible is a little risky these days because these capabilities do exist. It's much better to say, hey, where can I insert multiple tripwires or where can I combine multiple types of telemetry in order to still capture what the adversary is doing, just in case they are able to skip over one.
And having some detections on streaming logs alongside streaming logs or stuff like network that. Traffic, new account creation, privilege escalation, all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's multiple things to lean on there. And there's platforms that combine the telemetry and make it super easy to analyze. I understand like not everyone can deploy full packet capture, but you can get network metadata. Not everyone can deploy multiple endpoint agents. I wouldn't suggest that, but you could deploy an endpoint agent and forward event logs to a central repository. You could also, you know, like use point in time or kind of precision-based tools, which is, hey, an adversary who rolls into an environment and they deploy something like this, they might be blind or, you know, they might blind an EDR on a particular system or two, but at some point they're not going to be able to stay hidden. Right. Eventually, Chris, they're going to move ones and zeros in the wrong location and an alarm will get tripped somewhere, or at least it should. And just having visibility and eyes on glass there is going to be the best way to detect this type of thing.
Yeah. So Crypto24 is not the only group investing in these tactics. Sophos reports that at least eight other ransomware operations, including Ransom Hub, Medusa, Blacksuit, Quilin, Crytox, Dragonforce, Lynx, and Inc. or INC are similarly deploying EDR killer prior to ransomware payload execution. Many of these groups have adopted evolved versions of a tool derived from EDR Kill Shifter, a kernel mode attack framework that abuses signed but vulnerable drivers to disable EDR software. First spotted in August 2024 in use by Ransom Hub, EDR Kill Shifter has since been retooled by multiple crews, often with unique builds for each operation to avoid signature-based detection. In one documented case, Ransom Hub used a proprietary EDR killer that looked for a malicious kernel driver signed with a compromised certificate and identified by a randomized five-letter name. Upon locating it, the malware executed a bring-your-own-vulnerability driver, or BYOVD, attack to load the driver and exploit it for kernel-level access. This access enables threat actors to disable security defenses, gain persistence, exfiltrate data, and move laterally without triggering alerts. Targeted EDR products in these attacks include those from Microsoft, Symantec, McAfee, ESET, Cylance, and F-Secure, among others. A broader concern raised by researchers is the lateral movement potential once EDR has been neutralized. As Aviatrix Benson George pointed out, attackers are increasingly exploiting interconnects between cloud infrastructure components like VPCs, Kubernetes clusters, and APIs to extend their reach. When endpoint telemetry is lost, defenders often lose visibility into cross-system movement, making it even harder to detect or stop a breach in progress. To make matters more complex, not all EDR killers are malware. Cisco Talos has documented ransomware crews abusing HR Sword, a legitimate software product, to disable endpoint protections, a tactic that echoes how tools like Cobalt Strike have been repurposed by threat actors in the past. So yeah, a little bit scary sign of the things to come. Mm-hmm. It's an arms race. It never ends.
It never ends, my friend. They're constantly looking for ways. I find it always an interesting kind of challenge that blue teamers and defenders have to face is at some point you've got to say, okay, this is enough telemetry. Like, we can't overload an endpoint. We can't overload a system. We can't overload the SOC. Like, at some point we have to say, this is enough. Right. And then the flip side of that is, well, if the adversary can defeat and disable every single thing, I mean, really, what's our chances? You know? So I often kind of have this discussion with like SOC teams and IR folks and stuff like that. You know, when you're doing analysis, you try to pull and look for every single data source that you can to build a story of what happened at the time. When you're writing and crafting detections and looking for this activity, do the exact same approach. Don't try to automate the forensics of everything and pull every artifact back, but think about tried and true or really, really tough to defeat or get around telemetry streams that can offer really valuable insight that are also highly configurable. And I put a bunch of qualifiers in there, Chris, but when we talk, for example, about like Windows event log forwarding, you know, I don't mean forward every single event log that Windows generates and just be like, and just hope for the best, right? Instead, say, all right, where are my potential gaps? My potential gaps are in process monitoring and like PowerShell execution. Well, there's things you can enable to get more visibility into those. And then you can forward those details on if you're concerned, or you can use them as like starting jump points. Yeah. You know, so if your organization or your environment is really legitimately nervous and scared that someone's going to get in and disable your visibility software, then build, I hate to use the word moat, because a moat like stops people from getting in, but build different tripwires around the environment that say, look, you can disable one or two things. I'm going to catch you on the third. You can disable, you can download a piece of malware to do a thing. I'm going to catch you on the download. I'm going to build in smoke tests for if my EDR stops sending in process events or stops sending in certain things. Like, build all this stuff in.
Honeypots are great too.
Honeypots work as well. They're great ways to say something isn't right here and build those things in. I mean, I remember for years now, we've been big fans of Canary tools, Canary tokens and stuff like that. Like, really simple things you can just drop in your environment, relatively low cost, if not free. And these can be great little bellwethers of something isn't right here. Something's happening. Use those to your advantage. If this is a legitimate concern of yours, you know, is lean on those other mechanisms if you can.
Okay, so last up, a little bit of technical analysis from Microsoft. They took a look at Pipe Magic, a modular backdoor linked to ransomware operations carried out by Storm-2460, a financially motivated threat group associated with Ransom EXX. The malware has been active in the wild since early 2025 and is delivered under the guise of a fake open source ChatGPT desktop application. The disguise allows it to evade user suspicion and facilitates the installation of a sophisticated modular malware framework designed for stealth, persistence, and fine-grained control over compromised systems. Pipe Magic's architecture is organized around discrete modules that handle specific tasks such as command and control communication and payload execution. This design enables the malware to dynamically expand or alter its capabilities at runtime. Modules are delivered to the backdoor via a named pipe, and once received, they are stored in memory using four separate doubly linked list structures. Microsoft analysis indicates that three of these lists are for 1, raw payload modules, 2, already loaded modules, and 3, networking modules. The fourth list appears to serve as a dynamic handler for modules that are already in memory. So yeah, we talk about sophisticated threat actors. This sure looks like they are operating at a higher level than we normally see.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one. It's funny, being at Black Hat a couple weeks ago, there was quite a lot of discussion and analysis around finding and investigating named pipes and things like that. And this one ends up being a really interesting thing to think about from a blue teamer or from a defense perspective, if you will. First off, an awesome dissection, a very long article, but a great technical dissection by the team over at Microsoft Threat Intelligence or Microsoft Security, whichever one it is. They do pinpoint that this is in use by Storm-2460. It is masquerading as a legitimate ChatGPT desktop application. So there's the first kind of thing for everyone is watch out for, you know, wrong or dare I say, like, you know, incorrect or unapproved AI usage applications inside of an organization, one. And then two, they go in and do kind of talk about the technical analysis, Chris, and I love getting into this one. Pipe Magic, great name for a piece of malware, if you will. But it talks about their leaning on named pipes and just how the adversary uses and abuses them. And what I think that does is it really opens up to folks just how A, widespread these are, and then B, how well they can be kind of wrangled and taken advantage of by threat actors. Named pipes are widely used by other post-exploitation kits for daisy-chained lateral movement, process communications, intra-system communications, all sorts of things. And you know, if anyone here has ever used a tool like PSExec or PAExec or SMB transfers or any of the red team modules for lateral movement and stuff, you've likely interacted with them without even knowing them, but they also occur naturally every single day on an operating system. So they are noisy, noisy, noisy things that adversaries can just kind of fade in the back for.
Yeah, especially with some, you know, similarly named naming conventions and stuff like that, really hard to pick out what's malicious and what's legit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So the networking module plays a critical role in establishing and maintaining contact with the attacker-controlled infrastructure. Once command and communication is established, PipeMagic performs detailed system reconnaissance and awaits instructions. According to Microsoft, based on commands from the CNC server, the backdoor can A, execute its core payload, B, trigger a specific module, or C, relay messages back to the attacker, D, terminate the networking module and communication, or E, invoke all active modules with specific arguments. This capability provides Storm 2460 with a high degree of operational flexibility during post-exploitation phases. PipeMagic's backdoor functionality includes module enumeration and removal, process enumeration, recollection of system metadata, and even self-deletion. The malware's memory is a memory resident deployed without touching disk and further obfuscates its presence by modularizing functions typically found in traditional monolithic backdoors. Microsoft emphasizes that the use of a zero-day exploit, CVE-2025-29824, in conjunction with this modular malware, highlights a significant increase in adversary sophistication. The exploit was used to gain initial access and attacks spanning the US, Europe, South America, and the Middle East. While the number of observed victims is currently limited, the complexity and stealth characteristics of PipeMagic make it a high-priority threat. Microsoft concludes that exposing the malware's internal is key to disrupting the continued use and increasing the cost of operations for its operators. Yeah, something like this is, you know, got to be some high-level APT looking to exfiltrate data and do some long-term damage.
Yeah, agreed. I think this is one that's probably going to take a little bit of detection engineering work and certainly looking at the different ways that adversaries are abusing them, and Chris, really separating the wheat from the chaff in this one, you know, looking through and seeing how the adversaries do what they do and whatnot. There's a lot of information to pull on, looking at kind of the C2 connection here and some of the information that's gathered on the system and then sent out. There is definitely an element of network activity that could be detected here. One, two, I think this is yet another example where leaning in on different types of telemetry are going to be a really valuable source for detections and for blue teamers out there. But I'll add one little final part on this. This is where threat intelligence is going to be critical as well, Chris. This is where building in and integrating threat intelligence into your telemetry, your analysis, and what you're doing. You want something that comes back and identifies the various capabilities, strings, tooling, and functionality inside of PipeMagic, and then surfaces that on the list. Surfaces that, like, you know, in your analysis and stuff, and says, hey, I'm looking at 1,000 named pipes over the past 2 weeks across an entire enterprise. These 20 are clearly evidence of malicious activity. Let's go, let's go, let's go. As opposed to, well, let me just, you know, see what's in there and kind of doing statistical analysis or leaning on it. You'll identify it's malicious or suspicious, at least, or at least an anomaly, but knowing it's bad allows you to move a little bit faster with this. Yeah. So I would say this is another indication of where, like, you know, lean on the technical analysis that these security teams are doing out there and integrate CTI on what you're doing, folks. And you'd be surprised at how fast you can get to better results.
Yeah. And it's, this kind of research is just great for the community at large, because if you think about how much resources going into developing something like this, if we can just blow it out by making some IOCs available, that's going to put more costs on the attackers and make their life more difficult.
Absolutely. And I will drop one other little note in here really quick. We are talking about a Microsoft article. It builds on analysis from, I believe they called out ESET, but they have integrated protections into the Microsoft suite. So if you're hearing this and you're a Microsoft customer, you may or may not be protected there. But for everyone else, and we're not here to promote Microsoft, we're here to say for everyone else, double check with your vendors, make sure it's out there. And I'll offer one little final tip on this. Shadow AI, for lack of a better term, is becoming a big issue in a lot of organizations. I hear someone talk about this almost daily, where people are just downloading random AI applications because they want to use it, or they're used to using ChatGPT or whatever it might be, and they're not considering the implications of what that means or what the software might be capable of. So building a corporate policy around AI is another way to, I know we're talking about name pipes from an adversarial perspective and malware capabilities, but I want to zoom out and say one of the things that they've been successful for, as I mentioned, is distribution of a fake ChatGPT application, which once again, you know, I don't want my users downloading this thing. Yeah. So lots of pivots on ways we can protect the enterprise there.
Yeah. Awesome, Matt. Looks like we're at the end of another one.
Can't believe it. We made it. We made it. I don't know what number it is, but we're here.
Yeah, yeah. And next week, I'm going to have some new swag boxes to show off. So if somebody wants to fire us an email at defenders@limacharlie.io and give us some feedback on the show, doesn't even have to be good, I will happily send you a t-shirt.
So, yikes. I mean, we'd like the good feedback, but we'll take the bad feedback too.
Yeah, the point is to improve. So
yes.
Anything you got. Yeah.
Absolutely. Chris, always a pleasure being here with you.
Yeah, take care, sir.
See ya.
And that brings us to the end of another Intel Chat. You can support this show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend or subscribing and giving us a rating or leaving a comment on your chosen podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation and access the intel we talk about in real time, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.